I just want all of you to know that no one was more surprised than everyone in Colorado about the outcome of last night's game. We did not anticipate the Broncos doing that this year or next. So now we can turn our attention to college football, because that's probably the end of the Broncos' success for the year. This topic has been bothering me ever since I got asked to do this, and I've tried to spend a lot of time thinking about it, and it's not an easy thing to spend time contemplating, because it's beyond our reach, it's beyond our ability oftentimes to direct it, this whole notion of the future. But I about had my confidence up, and the other day I was talking to my sons. I told my son, I'll be gone for your game on Tuesday night. I said, well, where are you going? I said, I'm going to Missouri. And he said, well, what are you doing? I said, well, I have to give this talk about showing people the future. And there was this dead silence. And finally, one of them says, Dad, do they know you can't even find your keys? So I come in less confident than I was about this topic. Leave it to your children to show you the truth. I really have a huge appreciation for Thomas Jefferson and what he brought to this country of ours. And I just love this quote. I like the dreams of the future better than the history of the past. And that's really what I want to say more than anything else, is that the future is going to be awesome if we have the courage to dream about it. We face hard times as a nation, hard times as an industry, but the future is, in the long run, going to be what we make of it. You start trying to put together a presentation on this topic, and in the modern world, you do a Google search, and it's amazing. The first thing that popped up was from Charles Schulz, the great cartoonist. And Charlie Brown said, don't worry about the world coming to an end today. It's already tomorrow in Australia. So that was encouraging, and I liked that, and I was happy that was the first thing that showed up. And then I thought, you know, this is really a challenge. You know, I'd much rather have this talk with an organization that's struggling, because it's easier to have the conversation. Because when you're motivated by pressure and stress, you're open to almost anything. And so I thought, you know, what do you say to the most successful beef cattle organization in this country? And my first thought was to do the easy thing, and that was to say, boy, you guys are doing so great, and it's just awesome, and I don't think it'll ever come to an end, and just keep doing what you're doing. And get down and shut up. The bar would make a lot of money. Everybody would be happy, and it would be good. And then I stopped and thought to myself, but I respect these people too much to do that. And I also know that my job tonight is to be the warm-up band for the Garth Brooks and George Strait and all those guys that are on tomorrow. So I'm going to try to warm the band up a little bit. So I went ahead and did that Google search. The next thing that popped up was a very interesting quote from one of your ag economists at the University of Missouri. Thank you for making that go away. He said, farming is in crisis. People will continue to eat, and someone will continue to produce their food, but farming, as we have known it, almost certainly is coming to an end. That was a little more in the gut. But as I thought about it, and I've thought about the history of this business, Eric Hoffer was exactly right. In times of change, learners inherit the earth, while the learned find themselves beautifully equipped to deal with a world that no longer exists. And in the profession I'm in, part of the time at the university, we struggle with that all the time. And so it's a question of curiosity. I do know, though, what my job is tonight. And I'm going to do my best to accomplish this because I think it's important. It's only one night's sleep, and I'm sure the guys tomorrow will be much more comforting than I am. So as I think about the future, I think there are three big rules. Number one, don't let your success get in the way of your opportunities. And this is really, really difficult. If you study the history of organizations, the history of business, the history of education, the history of faith, this is really, really hard for people. Because once we get onto a winning idea, we don't want to let go of it, do we? It's hard to do. We have to deliver unique attributes via the marriage of innovation with core values. And that's another unique thing about this business, is that we are founded on these great traditions. And yet, we don't want those traditions to become millstones that hang around our necks, and yet there are some of the values that we should not ever sacrifice. And sorting that out, and I think as a country, we're in the midst of that right now. As a teacher, I see that that's the thing we're fighting with as a whole society, is how to sort out which things we keep and which things we innovate our way through. And the last one is get out of your comfort zone. And this is really an important one. And I think it's particularly hard for rural America to do this sometimes. Women do it pretty well. Us guys, we struggle with this. And so I'm going to try to help us get out of our comfort zone a little bit. Michael Goldhaber wrote a really interesting book about innovation technology, and one of the things he said, if there's nothing very special about your work, no matter how hard you apply yourself, you won't get noticed. And that increasingly means you won't get paid much either. And I think that's right on the money. The competition out there today is much more fierce than it's ever been. And if you don't get noticed, you don't get a chance to play in the game. Eleanor Roosevelt put it like this: do one thing every day that scares you. Now, when I tell my students this, I say, do one thing every day that scares you, not your parents. Just you. But since you're all older and wiser, I can say, just do the things that scare you. And I really mean that. And I think organizations have to do that. I think it's absolutely critical that we do that. So what are the big trends I see? Global competition is going to be fierce. There's nothing we're going to do about that except compete. We cannot wish it away. All we can do is compete. One of the really bright people at Intel said the world has arrived at a rare strategic inflection point where nearly half of its population living in China, India, and Russia have been integrated into the global market economy, many of them highly educated workers who can do just about any job in the world. We're talking about 3 billion people. Tom Peters said the other day, no job is America's God-given right anymore. That's a bitter pill to swallow. But the exciting thing about that is that if ever there was a nation who could create competitors, we should be it. It's just a question of whether we've gotten too soft to compete. I have a book on the beef industry that co-author, the late Bob Taylor, great man, that let me be part of this book. And we always thought at some point it would get translated. And about 2 months ago it showed up, translated into Mandarin Chinese. First translation, not into Spanish, not into Portuguese, where I thought it was going. And at first I thought, well, this is kind of cool, a book I wrote I can't read. This will be cool. It'll be a nice little, conversation piece. And then it hit me about an hour later, we'd had our eyes on the wrong competitors. China means to compete with us in the beef business. Because decisions on translations don't get made lightly in China. They're made centrally. And so they've got us in the sights. our customers in the future. I think this is a huge, huge piece of the puzzle for all of us. Some of you may have read a column I wrote for your Breed publication that more or less talked about the burden of accumulated aggravation. And I think that's where your customers are at. The regulatory climate that our customers face today burns their time and their energy. The economic climate adds to their uncertainty. Finding and keeping good help drains them. Marketing options, information, technology, those things evolve so fast that almost no one can adapt quickly enough to feel comfortable. So the customers of our future, the cow-calf people who are going to buy your genetics, what defines them? Well, one, they're just like consumers. They're time-constrained. They're increasingly averse to risk. They have minimal tolerance for unpleasant surprises and a keen desire for a two-way relationship with their genetic supplier. A lot of stress in our business, and they're looking for somebody to help take part of that stress away. I think our customers in the future are going to have a healthy skepticism about expensive or time-consuming technologies. I am not one of those academics who believes that every technology that comes down the line is a good one. They're not user-friendly. They're particularly worrisome to me. I think our customers are going to be profit-oriented, but they are going to have a strong preference for simplicity. As a result, I think the role of the seed stock sector will have to evolve as we move through time. This is sort of the way we do business today. We produce cattle that go out to commercial cow-calf enterprises that go on to feed yards and into the packing houses and on to food service and retail. And that's very cool unless you think long and hard about the future and you ask yourself the question, who in that chart is replaceable? And there's only one sector, the way I see it, that doesn't have to be there. Guess who that is? It's us. What we do can be replicated by someone else, potentially by our customers, especially in light of the technologies available to people today, but certainly by the supply chains, who will look not so much to sell bulls, but to provide genetic solutions to the people in their alliance and in their supply chain. Do I believe this is going to happen overnight? I don't think so. But is it in the realm of possibility that Harlan Ritchie was right? My guess is the answer to that is yes. It's possible that the seed stock sector could change dramatically in the next few years. So how do we stay in the game? I think it's called servanthood. And I think it's a monomaniacal focus on the needs of the commercial customer. And those who have that will win in the future. Keep in mind, while we're trying to do that, many large cow-calf producers will seek cheaper access to genetics. And we've got to really think that through. So we have to make sure we're adding real value, not just a bull, but real value that lasts. So, if this gets me thrown out of the room, that's okay, because there's a plane that goes back home tomorrow. I got to thinking about this, and I came across an article that Baxter Black had written back in the 1970s called The Story of the Herefords, and he really upset the Hereford industry because he said, you know, the problem with you guys, you're not cutting enough bulls. And they were riding pretty high then, weren't they? I think he was right. So if you really care about your customer, I think you go home, and over the course of the next month or two, you cut 10% more bulls this fall than you did a year ago. And you don't just get rid of them, you feed them. And you find out what they do. Because I think that's going to be really powerful in the future. Because in the age of stunning power of information, I am afraid, and based on a lot of conversations I've had with both packers and feeders in the last year, year and a half, the feed yard and packing sector knows more about your genetics and the performance of your customers' cattle than you do. and I don't mean that to be harsh or mean-spirited any way, shape, or form. I'm just afraid it's true. And they're capturing huge databases. You cannot believe the data being pulled together by the feeding and packing sector. It's amazing. They know more about what we're doing than we do. We can't let that continue. Information is the foundation of value in the future. The cattle are only carriers. The information is what matters. In the future, in my opinion, to serve the needs of the commercial cow-calf business partners is not an optional question. It's just a question of which partners. Strategically aligned teams have already been formed, and whether or not Angus Cattle wanted to go to the party or not, you're in every single one of them. So your dance card is full. It's just a question of whether you want to dance or not. I think in the future, breed's going to matter less. Notice I didn't say it's not going to matter. I said it's going to matter less. Because specific biological types designed to do specific things in specific systems to create specific outcomes will matter more than just breed. And I think with our customers, our consumer, that this great old ad from the pork industry, your hogs are being judged by people who think Chester White is a jazz musician. I think we have to be real, real careful not to get too proud of what we think about our product, because the consumer always has this unique habit of fooling us. Famous words of Larry the Cable Guy, the status quo ain't going to get her done. It's a great book called Zero Space, Moving Beyond Organizational Limits. I just love this quote. The organizations we have created have become tyrants. They have taken control, holding us fettered, creating barriers that hinder rather than help our businesses. The lines that we drew on our neat organizational diagrams have turned into walls that no one can scale, penetrate, or even peer over the top of. And we have to really think about that in the way that we look at our relationships with each other and with competitors and potential partners and our customers. Kevin Kelly, in a great book, Out of Control, this is a little harsh, but I think he's right. It's generally much easier to kill an organization than change it substantially. And lots of management thinkers suggesting that one of the best things you can do to a long-standing successful plan is to give serious consideration to killing it and starting over. Why is that? Because the silo mentality, which happens to successful organizations and has forever, almost always yields isolation. Almost always. Think about the American automobile industry in the 50s and 60s. Think about the large mainframe computing companies watching the hippies from Albuquerque coming along with Apple and Microsoft and thinking there's no way people are going to pack around their own computer. Think about the Pony Express and the railroads, because all of them got a silo mentality. They isolated themselves, and that yielded kaput, adios, nada. We don't want to go there. So it's innovation. Innovate, 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 and then invest and engage or fade into the sunset. I think you're at the most telling time in your organization's history. And that is the time now where you have reached this huge plateau and every organization gets to make a decision. You either maintain the status quo, which I guarantee you will yield a slow slide towards mediocrity, or you change your strategy. I am not smart enough to tell you what that strategy is, but study business and you'll find this trend. I can give you a little bit of advice. Read really weird stuff. If you go home tonight, or when you get home to your bed and you look at the nightstand and you notice that everything that on that nightstand has the word Angus or cattle or agriculture in it, you're not reading weird enough stuff. And I'm really serious. I mean, I think you should read Undaunted Courage and you should think what it would be like to be with Lewis and Clark. And I think you should read Good to Great, and I think you should read Purpose-Driven Life, and I think you should read Giuliani's story about leadership in the face of 9/11, and I think you should read about Thomas Jefferson, because I think there are answers there for where we're trying to go in the future. Meeting the needs of consumers in the future, you've been the absolute bellwether of how to go at this. And yet I think we've got to continue to think about how we move and change ourselves. Daryl Anderson, National Swine Registry, it won't always be about pounds, price, and production. It will be about added value, and I think we're starting to discover that. Take a look at Whole Foods. I don't know if any of you have not been to a Whole Foods or to a Wild Oats, you need to go. Okay? It won't be nearly as traumatic as you think. These are some cool retailers. They're cool. They're turning supermarkets into restaurants too, and they're doing some kind of neat sales stuff on a square foot basis, like doubling up Albertsons and nearly doubling up Walmart. Go take a look. Just look at beef in general and see who does the best job selling our product. Just beef. Go to Walmart, go to Albertsons, go to your Safeway, go to anyone you want to, and I bet it's going to be tough to beat Whole Foods. They're really good at selling our product, and they sell it for a ton of money. It's really cool. I like that. $798 a square foot in a $384 margin industry. That's cool. So what it comes down to is clients either want the best or the least expensive. And you know what? None of us can compete with Walmart on cost. They've already won that game. It's over. We can't compete with them, so there's no sense even getting in that game. So we're left with another deal. If you can't compete on cost, you're left with cool. And I'm not kidding. We got to start putting a little better language into our way of thinking. We got to start talking in words like cool. Because commodity is not much fun, and mundane never works. This is a cool thing from Ritz-Carlton Spas, their tagline, first we make the world revolve around you, then we gently slow it down. I think that's what your customers want. We live in chaotic times, don't we? This is crazy. I mean, we may not be interested in chaos, but it's sure interested in us. Wild times. We need people to slow things down for us. The prevent defense never works for very long. I used to think that the mark of a good businessman was to not make mistakes, but then I met a lot of successful business people and realized that the key to their success was they were willing to try a lot of things. That also means being willing to make mistakes. Gordon Segal, CEO, Crate and Barrel, pretty cool approach. And my question is as a large, successful organization, are you getting into the mindset of now how do we not make mistakes? How do we protect our lead? And how many football teams have you watched give away almost sure victory because they went into a prevent defense? They quit doing what got them there. Or they start doing real conservative things on offense. Because the reality is value chains are going to dominate the future. Notice I didn't say supply chains, value chains, things that really add value. I love this quote. Lexus sells its cars as containers for our sound systems. It's marvelous. Isn't that a completely different way to look at what it means to be the people who provide Lexus their sound system? Is that the kind of mindset we should have? I think it is. Supply chains, it seems, are really about talent, not technology, especially in the marketplace grows even more complex, and it will grow more complex. This is out of a study done by the guys at Harvard Business School. And they're exactly right. It's about talent. So how do we attract more talent? One of the big guns at Stanford in the supply chain world, Hao Li, says, we've discovered that those companies are great not because they were focused on cost or flexibility or speed, but because they have the ability to manage transition. Changing market conditions, evolving technology, different requirements as product moves through its cycle. The companies that can adapt are the ones that are here for the long term. And so the question is, in the face of change, how adaptable are you? And the technological changes coming at us are going to speed up. If we've been at supersonic speed, we are going well towards warp speed in the next few years. And here's the challenge for those of us in agriculture. The existing system of technology transfer, information system development, and education is not capable of meeting the needs of the beef industry in the future. This process has made me take a good look at what we do in my other life. And I'm scared to death because technological evolution is shaking agricultural research and development, communication, and tech transfer to its roots. The needs of the future are integrative and multidisciplined, even outside the box created by the agricultural disciplines, and yet we continue to do a lot of things the way we did them 50 years ago. And that's got to change. Okay, now let me really shake you up. I didn't actually dream this swamp up. My favorite management person in the world is a guy named Tom Peters. Tried to study him ever since I was about 23 years old. Why, I thought, how is it possible that brands could be dead? And what he was really saying is not that brands are dead, they're evolving. What he said is the death of brands and the birth of dreams. And now we're going to get into the really weird stuff. So if you need to go to sleep, this is a good time. Why are brands dying? Everybody uses them. They don't have any mystery anymore. They're not intriguing. They're failing to engage the new customer. Competitors imitate them and emulate them. Brands based on recipe approaches won't perform. And the problem with existing brands is they have this tendency, just because of human nature, to get in the prevent defense, which yields the steady slide into risk avoidance, which dulls brands back into commodities. That's the dilemma with brands as they are today. Rolf Jensen, Copenhagen Institute for Future Studies, said this: we're in the twilight of a society based on data. As information and intelligence becomes the domain of computers, society will place more value on the one human ability that cannot be automated, emotion. Now, I just know that every man in this room is just dying to have an in-depth discussion about emotion. Trust me, I'm as redneck as they come. This is not comfortable stuff for me. I am not happy up here having to tell you this. But I did enough reading, I've done enough studying, that I'm afraid that it's true. So the question is where are we on this scale, the experience ladder? Raw materials, that's where we used to be. Then we got into goods, then we got a little bit into services. We're kind of into solutions and success. But what about awesome experiences and making dreams come true? Where is each of your organizations, your companies, your farms, your ranches, where are they at on that scale? See, because a dream is a complete moment in the life of a client. Important experiences that tempt the client to commit. That's a cool word, commit. Substantial resources. The essence of the desires of the consumer. The opportunity to help clients become what they want to be. That's a little different realm, isn't it? That's more than a bull, isn't it? It's more than a set of EPDs. Now we're talking about making dreams come true. Kevin Roberts, I would strongly suggest you read this book. It's called Love Marks. Be a little uncomfortable for a lot of you because it suggests that emotion is so key. Kevin says, when I first suggested that love was the way to transform business, grown CEOs blushed and slid down behind annual accounts, but I kept at them. I knew it was love that was missing. I knew that love was the only way to ante up the emotional temperature and create the new kinds of relationships brands needed. I knew that love was the only way business could respond to the rapid shift in control to consumers. Remember, as an industry, when we said we wanted to be consumer-driven, be careful what you wish for, here we are, so now we've got to start talking about love. Imagination, myth, ritual equals the language of emotion. How many of you watched the movie Braveheart? Have you seen the movie Braveheart? Okay. I love that film because it is the language of myth and ritual and imagination that I can put in context. You go, you want to send that back one for me? Thank you. And Rolf Jensen is right. It'll affect everything from our purchasing decisions to how we work with others. Companies will thrive on the basis of their stories and myths. Companies will need to understand that their products are less important than their stories. That's pretty powerful. The story now is more important than the product. Why? Because the product can be replicated. So I just want you to think for real just a second, whatever your favorite brand image is in the food world, whatever it is, and I can imagine in this room what that is. Okay? And it's a good brand, and it's successful, and it's awesome. And then I want you to think about your own brand for your seed stock enterprise, what it is you provide your customers, and what your brand or your logo or whatever is all about. Put that in your mind's eye, and then I want you to close your eyes for a second. It's not so I can sneak out of the room. What is this whole thing about the story? Well, let me just read you from another company. This is Oregon Country Beef. Our product is more than beef. It's the smell of sage after a summer thunderstorm, the cool shade of a ponderosa pine forest, its 80-year-old weathered hand saddling a horse in the Blue Mountains, the future of a 6-year-old in a one-room school in the high desert. It's a trout in a beaver-built pond, haystacks on an aspen frame meadow. It's the hardy quail running to join the cattle for a meal, the welcoming ring of a dinner bell at dusk. Every time I read that, every time I hear somebody from that company say it, especially if it's Doc Hatfield, the founder, the hair on the back of my head stands up. I have to contain the Irish side of me that wants to cry at a moment's notice because that is exactly what I believe we're about. You think consumers can connect to that? Where do they sell their product? San Francisco, Portland, Seattle. Rough-hewn ranchers, direct marketing, face-to-face with consumers in some of the most liberal parts of the country. And they're selling their product like crazy because the story is so awesome. That's where we got to go. It's going to be more than just a bull. It's going to be the story behind the bull, behind the genetic program, behind you. So let me say a few things in summary. So what does the future take? It takes courage, and it takes creativity, and it takes cutting the ropes. You know, I think about Lewis and Clark. You know, they were not very old. They were like 22, 23 years old. Young guys, really young. And everybody on their crew was young. And they didn't have a lifeline. Jefferson just said, look, there's something over there. Come back and tell me what it is. And they did it. The equivalent in their time of going to the moon. They cut the ropes to do it. They couldn't leave a little trail behind them. They had to cut the ropes and move. Andrew Carnegie was right. Do your duty and a little more, and the future will take care of itself. So it's up to each of us. John Scharr said, the future is not some place we are going, but one we are creating. The paths to it are not found but made, and the activity of making them changes both the maker and the destination. I don't believe the future is an accident. I believe it occurs by intent. And we are poised at a point in time where by intent we can create that future. Isabel Allende put it perfectly. You are the storyteller of your own life, and you can create your own legend or not. My notion, let's be Lance Armstrong. Let's go create a legend. Thank you so much.